Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with the brilliant composer, conductor, multi-instrumentalist, jazz musician, and author, David Amram. He has composed more than 100 orchestral and chamber music works, written many scores for Broadway theater and film, and in the jazz world, he's been all over the place, literally. He's recorded with the bands of Lionel Hampton, Oscar Pettiford, Charlie Mingus, Mary Lou Williams, and Kenny Dorham. And he conducted the very first jazz poetry readings in New York City with Jack Kerouac back in 1957. Recently, he attended the Folk Alliance in Kansas City and spoke about his relationship with Charlie Parker and Kansas City jazz. He has been hailed as one of the most versatile and skilled musicians America has ever produced, and that's the truth. Over the course of our conversation, he wove an intriguing tapestry of conversation about jazz, his life, the journey, and his brilliant dose of meter, full of wit, humor, warmth, and a traveled wisdom that is truly cool. An ambassador for jazz, music, and living very well. Enjoy this interview, my friends.
David, thank you for taking a little time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it. So what I'm going to do is I want to first of all start with your recent visit to Kansas City that you spoke about. How was that trip here?
It was really incredible. I have been to Kansas City many times in my life, and I was blessed to play and record with Mary Lou Williams when she had moved to New York City and Pittsburgh and all the other places that she lived. And she always told me about her days in Kansas City and what she had contributed to that amazing time and what that amazing time had contributed to her. And then having met Charlie Parker in 1952, when I was lucky enough to spend some time with him, he told me about some of his experiences growing up there, where he knew that I'd been brought up on a farm in Easterville, Pennsylvania, as well as living in the South, and talked about his boyhood there and what it was like with the community of musicians, which is very similar to the community of musicians in Washington, D.C., yeah, where I met him in 1952, which was still a southern city at that time, and still officially segregated, and where there was an enormous interchange among musicians, in spite of the fact that it was supposed to be officially segregated. I lived in what was called the checkerboard neighborhood, where black and white folks lived together. And he told me, even with the different musicians' unions, how much there was a musical community where everybody was welcome as long as they were sincere and had some respect for their elders and what that had meant to him. And then when I met Lester Young, he also personified that very special feeling of someone who had become, I guess, along with Charlie Parker and Count Basie and all those incredible musicians that came through there way back at that time and helped to create a whole style of music. There was a certain sense of community. And they all told me that when they traveled to other places like Detroit and Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia and Chicago, as well as New York City, that there were communities at Indianapolis, of course, Naptown, all over the country. There were places where jazz was considered to be very special representation of the highest level of what was happening in our whole culture.
Yeah.
Even though it was restricted, not just by what you might call racism, but by a lack of deep appreciation on the part of what they call the pure culture, the main culture.
Yeah.
And that combined with the music business made the conditions of these great artists almost impossible. What they called the Chitlin circuit, mm-hmm, which was no treat to spend your life working in,
yeah,
still produced some of the greatest music now in the year 2015, we can all be the recipients of all that beauty. So as a recipient of that beauty myself as a teenager and as a kid growing up, now that I'm 84, my gig is to try to share a fraction of that spirit and that beauty and that yay-saying, positive, creative, great energy and devotion to music on its highest level that jazz personifies. So coming back to Kansas City, at this Folk Alliance, where I was happy to say that I was included not only as someone who played with the wonderful folk artists from Pete Seeger and Odetta and on up to hundreds of other people, but also to be able to share some of the blessings and the treasures that I've received from the great jazz artists, all of whom, of course, loved folk music, loved European classical music, loved any kind of sincere music from the heart. That's what jazz basically was built on, as community music coming from the sanctified church and the blues and anything else that was around that was beautiful and accessible and worth studying. An open-hearted, open-minded, open-ended way of dealing with life and with music. So here I was in Kansas City in 2015 with a whole bunch of young folks who, unlike myself, weren't fortunate enough to have their YouTube be their entire life. My 84 years of Hangoutology was my YouTube. Yeah. And here are some young people that could go on YouTube and see the Kansas City Masters and hear the Kansas City Masters, play along with them, watch them, and then turn off the computers and go hang out. My concern was, as a lot of people, especially those of us over 80, is that a lot of the spirit might be lost, because yeah. It's not like studying real estate taxes or astrophysics. It's similar in terms of the knowledge that you'd like to have. But music and jazz especially is so much more than that. And the more than that is not something that you can buy in a bottle or purchase from a guru with a limo or from a psychiatrist or a dope dealer. It's something that you have to live and be around those who have lived that, a certain extraordinary attitude that these musicians all shared of survival and revival. Because yeah. it's a spiritual thing as well as an intellectual and musical one. I hate to use the word spiritual, because then right away you think of some fake New Age hustler trying to make a Burger Kingization of ancient religions they don't know anything about. So generally when I hear the word spiritual, like other people, I reach for my wallet to make sure it's still there. it's not about some, you too can be a great guitar player or have a great head of hair or have no wrinkles in 30 seconds if you lay out the money. It's not about that. It's a whole much deeper, more rewarding approach towards life and approach towards music. And it's something that you spend your whole lifetime trying to develop. So when I came to Kansas City with all that I mentioned, I was hoping, because I had come here the year before, maybe there could be some way that I could do the same thing when I came with the Kansas City Philharmonic, as they called it back then, in the 70s, when they did the world premiere of Black, Brown, and Beige for Symphony Orchestra, which Maurice Perez had orchestrated and conducted and premiered. And they also did some of my music, and I guess conducted the orchestra too. But I hoped that in addition to that, I could do what I did during that time, which is when I went to the Charlie Parker Center, or School of Music, I think they called it way back then, And then suddenly I realized, here I was the only guy at the school who actually knew Charlie Parker, having been blessed to meet him in 1952. And I forgot, of course, that time had marched on, and that a lot of the people had either left Kansas City and hadn't come back, or had left the planet. So my hope was, in the year 2015, I could do something. And sure enough, the Folk Alliance was nice enough to have me do a program which was dedicated to the lineage of Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and Charlie Parker. Not to say that they were all the same, but they all came from that same place of loving, appreciating, and respecting all musics, including our indigenous American musics, with an S on the end, with jazz and the blues, of course, being such a huge foundation from which all rivers flowed. And sure enough, the one program I did that was a class was the one, I guess, that you saw written up by the gentleman. I don't know who it was, but it was lovely what he said, where he described the whole weekend. And he mentioned what I did. And to my pleasure, when I mentioned, I said, is anybody here from Kansas City? Over half the audience said, yo, and raised their hands. I said, wow.
Yeah.
Here's a music event, National Folk Alliance, International Folk Alliance, where they had people from Australia and England, and two guys in kilts from Scotland, a bunch of folks from Canada, and countries all over the world, and all over the United States coming to Kansas City. And it wasn't the kind of thing where somebody comes into a town and all the people in town hide. Say, man, I'll be glad when these cats leave so we can go back to being ourselves.
Yeah.
Here was something where they had a bunch of young musicians and some older musicians from Kansas City as part of the programming. I said, boy, if that's the case, this is something I'd like to come to every year, which it looks like I'm going to be fortunate enough to be able to do. And I met so many incredibly good musicians. They had these little sort of jam sessions in people's rooms. There was a young violinist whose name I never did learn. He was probably only about 20 years old. Young guy who was like incredibly good. And he was playing with the folk players and the blues players. He was one of those guys that knew what to do, whoever he played with. So I moved. He had a true jazz background and a true Kansas City background, because that's the attitude that musicians in New Orleans have, and places anywhere where music is a part of life, and you realize your highest role is to be able to fit in with anybody and everybody, enhance what they're doing. When in doubt, leave it out and try to make every note a winner.
Yeah, without a doubt.
So it's a wonderful, wonderful, I'm embarrassed to say, everybody at the festival knew their names except me. A fabulous singer who's also a very accomplished actress up there, who plays the mandolin, and her husband, who's a killer guitar player and singer. And they have a duo that plays all over Kansas City. And they had two musicians from Kansas City who were just playing with them. And I went into one little room and I was just floored. Yeah. I was just sitting there in awe. They were so terrific.
Cool.
And sure enough, they came up on my little show and played a piece with me.
Right on.
There was a pup. And then there were other people who told me they were from Kansas City, and I didn't even have a chance to write their names down, because it would be like 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd just all be playing together. But I saw so many young players who were so terrific, and they also had the ability to play with people who weren't jazz musicians per se and know what to do.
Yeah.
When I played with Dizzy Gillespie on a wonderful show I did with 1977 Soundstage, I had a whole program. I did a piece with the Chicago Symphony and with a wonderful group I had with Pepper Adams and Jerry Dagian and all the people, group called Típica Sacienta Tres, which was a wonderful group from New York in the 70s, great Latin Afro-Cuban musicians. All of those players loved different kinds of music. And when Dizzy was playing with Jethro Burns, the great mandolin player, we did one piece of sort of like a bluegrass piece with an Afro-Cuban rhythm section. Dizzy said, "This is the kind of stuff I used to hear when I was a little boy growing up in the South." And Jethro Burns, who's the great mandolin player with Homer and Jethro, who was playing mostly folk music or country music, was a killer jazz mandolin player, which he never got a chance to do. Just as Vassar Clemens, who was in the Army with him in 1952, they called it hillbilly jazz. Actually, it was just Vassar Clemens playing music that he loved. But there were so many musicians always who appreciated one another's music and could play with one another. And the whole time I was in Kansas City, I sensed that. And every event I went to, when I heard some of the Kansas City musicians playing, I was just bowled over by how terrific they were, and that they have taken that spirit and moving it right along to make it their own, because that's the whole idea. Something beautiful doesn't mean it's supposed to be fixed in time. If you're going to be a composer, you don't have to wear a white powdered wig and write with a quill pen in order to honor Bach.
Yeah.
You just have to study his music and submit yourself to that beautiful choice of exquisite notes and then figure out what you're going to do and use that as a fount of inspiration and a set of standards. And what the Kansas City musicians did for jazz sets a standard, just as the musicians from New Orleans did and the musicians today like Donald Harrington and Henry Butler and all these phenomenal people of today and the whole Marsalis family and Trombone Shorty and an army of others are doing, along with the Preservation Jazz Hall Band that's playing the way people used to play way back then.
Yeah.
And they all play together and do concerts together and they respect each other. And I got that same sense in Kansas City in 2015. And it was so wonderful also to meet the head of the Jazz Museum. And rather than being someone, a cultural anthropologist with a huge bottle of formaldehyde, he was actually a musician who played that music himself and also had great administrative skills. And I met the gentleman who was in charge of marketing, and he was also not only a successful business person and a 20-year veteran in the military, but also was a musician who could play the music.
Yeah.
And all the years I spent in Europe when I was in the Army and afterwards, when I, back in the 50s, when I was able to play jazz concerts in the same places where you play symphony concerts, and see not only the reverence that people had for jazz as music to listen to, but also understood what the music was about, I realized because all those people in charge of the store, so to speak, had some background in music.
Yeah.
So the fact that Kansas City has a international folk festival where the people in charge play themselves, which is certainly a wonderful thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Lewis, who had me come, is a terrific banjo player. And when I got off of the plane, even though I was wiped out and my bag was lying in the hotel lobby, I just went and I said, Lewis Myers, I said, Lewis, come on, play some banjo, man. So he got off behind his administrative duties, took out the banjo, we played for an hour. He said, well, you better check into the hotel. I said, yeah, I guess I better before someone takes my room. But I was having so much fun, I didn't even get to the front desk until I played for an hour. And here was someone running that whole part of the festival who played. And that's a really important thing, I think. And we can hope the arts in America can follow Kansas City's example of having people in charge who know what they are in charge of.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd much rather have someone who's the Secretary of the Navy at least having been a lifeguard or something.
Yeah.
Where at least they knew how to dive into the water, if nothing else, rather than being a brilliant administrator, but never been the inside of a ship or never been out to sea or didn't even know, you know, what life in the water was about. That's scarcely a very heavy thought. But sometimes we forget that the people, folks in charge, are supposed to be also veterans of what they're in charge of.
That's right. That's right. When did you know in your life that you were going to dedicate yourself to being the person that you are, which is a very artistic, musically driven individual that's been all over the map with the best creative forces that have ever been on this planet? At what age and at what mentality did you say, this is what I'm going to do?
Well, you know, I'm still trying to do it. I'm not dodging it, but I never made a choice like people said, you're an amazing careerist. I've never had a career. I'm not interested in one. I said, I love music, and I hope someday what I've composed and what I've, you know, written down on paper and what I've recorded that I've written down on paper as a classical composer and what I've played, I hope someday my music will have a career of its own to the extent that it'll inspire some other person I'm probably never going to meet to say, hey, I think I'm going to try and do that myself, even if my career counselor tells me it's impossible. My hope is that what I do can foster creativity in others and give anybody who, you know, hears it some pleasure, and that when I'm out as in the role of a player or side man or accompanist or band leader, whatever, I can give some other people a good feeling.
Absolutely.
And that's really the, I think, the only thing that's important, and also the only thing that gives me any satisfaction.
Yeah.
Because all the other stuff comes and goes in a minute.
Yeah.
And you can watch that wonderful show on TV called Where Are They Now?
Yeah.
And they show the person, you know, working in the 7-Eleven or the gas station, and then they show them playing at a stadium 3 years prior to that. And, of course, very often the person who's playing in the stadium is dispensable. They appear in a record where half of it's played by other people.
Yeah.
And then when their last record tanks out, then they, on such an enormous scale, they don't get any gigs. Well, the good thing about jazz and folk music and symphony music and chamber music and Latin music and Native American music, Middle Eastern music, all those kinds of musics are, they're coming from a different place. They were never driven by what became a billion-dollar industry in the 60s when the gigantic music industry took over the whole scene and no longer reflected what musicians felt was the best that they could do.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of great people since that time, and there are plenty of great people today. And with YouTube and the internet, we have the blessings of seeing and hearing them. So they're no longer destined to the landfill. But so much of the terrific music got lost and vanished because people figured it was no longer saleable.
Yeah.
And there are even stories from people I know who work for these gigantic record companies where they took Caruso records and things of that nature and destroyed them because they were taking up space and people figured they weren't going to ever sell anything. Not to mention fantastic, great jazz records that were made. Just amazing, amazing music. And, of course, all the music that wasn't recorded. Now, as we speak, someone in London wants to make a box set of all the jazz music that I've used in films that I composed for the film Splendor in the Grass way back in 1960. The great Buster Bailey and Eddie Wilcox played on some of the things I wrote, which were reflecting, you know, the 1920s type of jazz when the film took place. And the Manchurian Candidate, the great Harold Land played with all these other wonderful artists that I knew. And a film called The Young Savages, Harold played, and we had the old jazz and Latin music, which has never seen the light of day. And now, 55, 56 years later, I guess, when it finally comes out, all these things will surface.
Yeah.
And I'm really pleased, not just for myself, but so that these great players can also be heard.
Absolutely.
And I realize 56 years is kind of a long time, but as they say in New York City, when you're waiting to get your cup of coffee and 2 hours have packed, passed, the place is packed, and you have to go back to work, and you say, I don't mean to be rude, but can I get my cup of coffee? I've been here 2 hours. The response is, what's the rush? So it's... In a certain way, you have to apply that in your own life, you know, to be patient. To figure, most important thing is to try and do a good job.
Yeah.
Have it really come off well and make sure everybody in the band gets paid.
Yeah.
Those are the real obligations.
Absolutely.
And everything else you just hope for. And if you dwell on inequities or disappointments of the past, you'd be so paralyzed by anger, rage, and fear that you stop being creative.
Right.
So as Monk said in his classic song, Straight No Chaser, or as Kansas City's own Charlie Parker said in 1945 with his classic song, Now's the Time.
Yeah, that's right. That's totally right. You know, I want to talk to you, I want to kind of focus a little bit on your jazz life. Your life is so prolific, but the one thing that I do to be around, to be the first person to get the recordings with Jack Kerouac, what was it like to be around a human being like that? What did he teach you? What's been the residual ripple effect of Jack Kerouac, knowing him as a person and a friend and recording his poetry and being around that creativity? What has that been like for you?
Well, it was just a joy to know him. We were at a bring-your-own-bottle party, BYOB, they used to call it, in 1956 at a painter's loft. And this guy in a black-and-white checkered shirt, like the French-Canadian lumberjacks are known to wear, came up to me, handed me a bunch of papers and said, play for me. Then he took the papers back before I could read them. So I didn't have my penny whistles with me, and there was no piano, no percussion. So I took out my trusty French horn and started playing. And the minute he started reading, I have no idea what he read, I could just feel that connection.
Yeah.
Same thing as when I played the very first time with Thelonious Monk at his apartment. I played with Mingus, and Monk had come down, and somehow Willie Jones, the drummer, said, Monk Diggs, you're playing. I couldn't believe it. And he called me up, and sure enough, I used to come over there. The second he would play one chord, or when I played with Duke Jordan, the great piano player who played with Bird out in Brooklyn, and it was my turn to play, and I heard this chord. It was just like a sound from heaven. Just took me right up, swept me up into doing something I couldn't do. It was that way with Jack when he started reading. I just felt something that just carried me on to doing something and figuring out what the right thing to do would be. And we had such a good time doing that at different bring-your-own-bottle parties. And he'd run off to go dancing with someone, and I'd be carrying on, and we'd stumble into each other. After about the fourth time, he told me he'd come from Lowell, Mass., a small mill town. I'd come from Priesterville, Pennsylvania, and then Washington, D.C., and he'd been in the Merchant Marines, which my uncle had been for years, and he spoke French at home, and I'd learned that from my mom, who translated French. So when I flunked it every year, I had to study it, so I was brought up against my will learning the language. And also someone who loved Bach and Charlie Parker and Big Spider Beck and Count Basie and Mr. Young and just about everybody you could think of. And also appreciated painting and poetry, sports, and most of all, anybody and everybody who crossed his path. Just open-hearted, open-minded, wonderful guy. And of course, he became a famous figure overnight. He had no way of dealing with that, and really no interest in being a celebrity. He was just a wonderful, warm person, a very strong church goer, which was considered to be a crime against humanity. If you're a big time, certainly a big time New York City author of the year, you're supposed to be Mr. Stuff Church. Snobble, only speak to five important people. He was more of the way Dizzy Gillespie was when we played in a small place. Dizzy would go out and hang out with all 60 people in the audience before the show started, leave his dressing room door open, and we'd stay there an extra 2 hours just hanging out. And Jack was the same way. Just real warm, always interested in what other people were doing. Very inspiring to be around.
Yeah.
And also extremely sensitive, and got very upset if people were trying to put him or anybody else on a pedestal. He was really very much someone who, I think that's why he understood jazz as much as he understood Bach and Beethoven, because he could feel what the music was about, and he could feel what the people were about who played that music. And he could respect the culture and cultures that that music came from.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, as an embodiment of, as you described with Kansas City, bringing that essence of jazz, that warmth, that humanity, that love of the craft, when you meet people and you kind of take the temperature of America in 2015, do you feel people are receptive to the beauty of this real original American invention known as jazz?
I think more than ever, if they can get a chance to peek through that curtain and see and hear the army of people out there who can do it better than ever.
Yeah.
The problem is now that that curtain is so enormous and overwhelming, and the information highway that we have is so full of superficial, supercilious trash jammed down our throats, an avalanche of swill dumped upon us 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
That if you don't know that there is such a thing as beauty, it can be right in front of you, and you get numbed because you're trying to ward off all those stupefying, unsatisfying, unnutritious bad vibes of slop dumped upon us by the slopmeisters, who are people that generally never learned to sing, dance, draw, tell a joke, hang out with anybody, or have a romance or anything. Very often flunked out of law school and are strung out on drugs. Often those are the people who decide what is supposed to be entertaining, what we deserve, and themselves are culturally deprived, so they don't have a clue of what might be valuable.
Yeah.
However, there are people that do have the clue, and again, with either the internet or YouTube, you can find that needle in the haystack. And in fact, you can become your own haystack and even become your own needle in the haystack. Then you can turn off the computer and find out that there are some other people. Back in 1951, that's when I met Dizzy, a year before I met Bird, my basement apartment was kind of the center for all the nutcases, of which I was certainly one of the primary ones, I guess, who hoped that there could be. I was extra horn in the National Symphony, and I was kind of a jazz group that played Renaissance music, transcriptions of Bird and Monk and Dizzy that we tried to write down, Latin music, and some of my chamber music or classical music. We did all different kinds of music, and all different kinds of people come. One guy from New Orleans came, and he told me, he said, I'm one of the five people in New Orleans that digs modern jazz. This was 1951.
Wow.
And there was a great player named Earl Turbington who never left New Orleans, who was a master of what they called modern jazz as well as everything else. And almost all the jazz players at that time who were playing that music also could play the old-time music. And contrary to all the junk that was written, what were called, not by musicians, but by writers about music, molding figs, those who only played Dixieland or older music, all appreciated all the music that was being made. When I went to Cuba with Dizzy Gillespie in 1977, they had the Empire Brass Band, which played old-time music, come to serenade the boat when we went off. And they saw us up on the boat and said, Dizzy, come on down and play with us. So Dizzy and I was invited me to come and play with them. We were jamming with them for an hour. And they loved Dizzy. And when you see some of the things on YouTube of Dizzy and Louis Armstrong playing together, they loved and admired one another.
Yeah.
If you read about it, supposedly they were enemy camps. That's just something that is okay to read about. But the people that wrote about that, I don't believe ever hung out for 5 minutes with any of the musicians who created the music or any of the fans who loved anything that was beautiful and meaningful.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that the hope for all of us is to see that all things of beauty have a place that are different, just like they're different languages, and each language has its own subtleties and varieties. Not all of them are correct because they all reflect a certain cultural heritage. And Kerouac was sensitive to all of that, to the nuances of American life.
Yeah.
So people would say, well, how can a guy be a great novelist and scat sing and hang out at a party and talk to the janitor all night as well as the person who's giving the party and enjoy everybody and everything and be so interested in people that cannot advance his status of the moment?
Yeah.
And that was something that he kind of convinced me, that the only thing worse than being totally obscure in our culture is being accepted, because at that point you have to move to the next level. And then, of course, you're subject to the greatest crime you could commit in American culture, which is to fall out of fashion.
Yeah.
So those of us that say, well, man, we don't care if we're in fashion or not.
Yeah.
One of the best reviews I had for my last book, I've written three vibrations, one called Offbeat Club, my last book called Upbeat, Nine Lives and a Musical Cat. They quoted the great improvising actor Gary Goodrow, who was in the play called The Connection with Jackie McLean and Freddie Redd, all those great musicians played in. And I knew him since way back then. And we were out in San Francisco where I was playing jazz, and also they were playing a cantata at the San Francisco Opera House. And he was commenting on the fact that I had made my life choices of pursuing all the forms of music that were considered to be hopeless. And he said, I think you're really going to successfully complete your life of never being fashionable for your entire life if you continue. And I congratulate you for pursuing that unusual career path of not trying to have a career, but, you know, just trying to, I guess, be the best musician I could hope to be.
Absolutely.
And that's what I found with I was a man named Albert Nicholas. When I was in Paris in 1955, Albert Nicholas must have been in his 70s then. He was a friend of Sidney Bechet's and one of the old-time players that moved to Europe, stayed there, was beloved, made a good living, had fun, had a great life, just playing in Europe. And we were trying to play the latest things that we heard from Monk, which are really some gorgeous tunes, but hard to play correctly and play the right chord changes. And then after you do that, playing something besides just running those changes and actually, you know, creating something from that framework. It was hard to do that. And he said, man, he said, I'm going to go home and practice. I want to get out with you cats to see if I can improve. And that was a good role model for me. And at 84, every time I go out and play, I feel the same way, including guys who play in my group who are so good. I try to keep up with them. And that's the nice thing about jazz. It keeps you on your toes because each time you're playing, it's the first or the last time. And it's always a challenge to try to figure out what to do and how to do it and then to appreciate what everybody else is doing. And
absolutely.
Hope that somebody in the audience might enjoy it too.
Yeah. Yeah, without a doubt.
Even though you forget about all that when you're playing, but you can feel the people, if they're feeling something, they give a feeling back to you. And it's not about showing off or standing on your head or that kind of stuff. It's just about the shared experience. And I can't explain it, but it's almost like that the music takes over and tells you what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it would have to be a symbiosis. I mean, the energy that you're putting out would have to be something would be reciprocated by their enjoyment of what you're doing.
Well, Tony Bennett was the one that actually told me about that. I was doing some weird TV show with him called The Mike Douglas Show back in the 70s. And they had a, you know, run through, because those things weren't quite that spontaneous. They tried to sort of say, here's, we're going to ask you three questions and then want you to play and then do the, you know, had everything figured out. So for the rehearsal, they had a whole room full of women who were in the audience, almost all of whom had that white hair that was tinted slightly blue. I guess that was style back in the 70s. And I looked out and said, boy, and they were just sitting there like they were all watching TV.
Yeah.
I said, oh my goodness. It was really pretty weird.
Yeah.
And Tony Bennett had been, at that time, was always a great singer, always working, whether it was after I left my heart in San Francisco, he had played in church places. At this point, he had a new records on, I guess, that were doing that well. So he was playing at some little place in Cherry Hill till 4 in the morning, you know, and he came in and was, yeah, he goes, oh, let me talk. You know, he was still hoarse and hadn't slept more than 4 hours. And he got talking about that and singing. And the minute he started singing, suddenly all these women with the white hair and the dye blue hair, suddenly you could feel this burst of energy. They all came to life.
Yeah.
I said, wow, that was something. And I said, Tony, after this, man, that was incredible. You made all those women so happy and come to life. You could just feel the whole room warm up. He said, man, he said, that's what I learned from Louis Armstrong. I said, what do you mean? He said, you put it out and they give it back. And then what they give back, you put out again and they give it back. And then you put it out again. And he said, that's what they call catharsis, which is, of course, what Plato wrote about in his dialogue.
Yeah.
So who would ever think that Louis Armstrong would be showing Tony Bennett, telling me at 11 o'clock in the morning about catharsis?
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's what it is. And
yeah,
that's a magical, healthy, beautiful thing. And it's free. And you can't buy it. And you don't have to sell it. It's just one of the beautiful forces in nature.
Absolutely.
Like seeing a gorgeous sunset.
Without a
doubt.
Or
hearing the birds sing.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to have a battery of lawyers, accountants, attorneys, representatives, bodyguards, etc. to experience beauty. And you don't have to have any of that to share the beauty. And once you see that that's our gig in life, then you can think about that. And that in turn can make other people feel good about their job.
Yeah.
So whatever they're doing, they can try and do better than is expected and feel better about themselves. So that's why jazz is a very good thing for everybody to know about, to hear, to experience, if you get a chance to play or to sing, and to be around, because it's a way of dealing with every situation in life, including adverse situations, and using the turnaround and making the negative positive and keeping on keeping on.
Absolutely.
Accepting your own clinkers. I remember one time, two great stories. When I was playing with Mingus at the Bohemian, someone came in to see Miles and said, "Man, I said, I've been here for a half hour. I said, the guy turned his back and the audience has to play one note. He said, I want my money back." I said, no, with Miles, it's not what he's playing, it's what he's thinking.
Yeah.
And the second one was when somebody was singing and really got out there, and the drummer said, "Man, what's the matter with this singer? She's singing the wrong attitude. She's singing the wrong lyrics to the wrong song. She's singing a different bridge." I said, "No, she's a stylist." So on a certain level, that means that you can look for the positive part and accept almost anything and figure what someone else does is correct for them, and you can find your own way to do what you think is correct. And understand that all the world doesn't have to be one big robot doing the same thing all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. You have done an amazing job in your oratory here of basically answering in kind of a ping pong fashion all of the questions. And you've done something that I didn't expect would happen with this interview, but you succinctly and beautifully define jazz in a way that has really blown my mind. I've only heard one other way. I talked to Randy Weston recently, and he explained, because he's been to Africa so much, how when he was there, everything swung. There was a swing, that elephant trunks, the way the trees did, without any human beings being there. It was a swinging place, and that's how the swing and the jazz came to America. And what you've done with your oratory and your story is you've woven a very, very rich tapestry of story and a beautiful song, the jazz. And I think, without getting mired with a lot of other questions that I could throw in, I think what you've done is you've taken a slice of conversation and made it a beautiful testament to jazz. And I think I'm good with resting with what you've done with our interview. And I'm deeply appreciative that I've had the chance not only to speak with you, but you've been so gracious to open up a Pandora's box of conversation with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I thank you, and I just hope for all your listeners, you know, if your kids play, or kids, if your parents play, or if nobody plays, you'll all come and listen and feel at home. And if you are someone who's interested in being in that world, whether as a player, as a listener, as a fan, as a singer, or a member of the audience, or all of the above, that you continue to try to fulfill that desire, and you won't be wasting one second of your time.
Yeah.
Even if you spend a whole day trying to learn how to play Giant Steps as Peter Man, it's too hard. I can't do it. You can remember Al Cohen's famous story when they said, "Al, how do you like Coltrane's record of Giant Steps?" And Al said, "I love it." They said, "Well, Al, you play more like a style of Lester Young than anything that Coltrane's doing. What do you think of that tune?" He said, "I think it's fabulous." He said, "Isn't that hard?" He said, "Nah." He said, "It's a piece of cake, but I use my own set of changers."
That's great.
And the idea of making jazz foreboding, and I didn't see it, so I can't really comment on that new film, but I did see the trailer.
Yeah.
Where they showed the guy who's like a prison guard abusing and assaulting the person who's supposed to be learning how to be a successful jazz musician.
Yeah.
And turning it into something like training for the Navy SEALs or something. And with all due respect, jazz is a much more welcoming, totally the opposite of that, at least as far as I've ever experienced. Kansas City is really the opposite of that. And I would just say that there's a big welcome mat out for everybody with that kind of music. And it's something that just kind of enriches your life. And when I played the Ottawa Jazz Festival, we did a Duke Ellington program, and I conducted the Ottawa Chamber Orchestra, and we had jazz artists playing Duke Ellington symphonic compositions along with the symphony. It was just amazing. The next night, Wynton Marsalis' band came. They had the biggest turnout. He had that wonderful Duke Ellington concert. And I just sat out in the audience. There was about 12,000 people. And I was blown away. Everybody was just sitting there listening to the music.
Yeah.
It was so wonderful from every walk of life. And when I played Farm Aid with Willie Nelson, one of the great things about Willie is he's really a jazz oriented player with that philosophy and that spirit that plays the wonderful kinds of music that he plays, but always with that feeling of being together, never playing the same thing over and over and over again, even when he plays the same song,
yeah,
and always being warm and always welcoming other people. And that's a terrific thing. That's the hallmark of jazz, and ultimately reminds everybody in music what all musics are about.
Yeah.
So it's a big blow for mental health at a time when we can all sure use it. And I thank you for having me on your program. I wish everybody in Kansas City continual love and appreciation.
Absolutely.
What a wonderful place it not only has been, but remains and is now.
Beautiful. David, it's been a profound, immense joy to speak with you. Thank you again for taking your time out. I appreciate it.
Oh, man, it's my treat. And I'll look forward when I get back to Kansas City, which I hope to, certainly to meet you in person.
I'd love to. It would be a huge pleasure.
And you could continue what you're doing because, you know, just like when you play, you get one person to pay attention that didn't, you can help to change their life. And in turn, that person, you'll get some other people to do the same thing.
Absolutely.
And that's the stuff that really lasts and has some value. Everything else just comes and goes in a minute. Okay, well, listen, thanks, and good luck with what you're doing, man. Continue doing it.
You too, man. Thank you, David. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and ambassadors of jazz in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over this country and world. And thanks to the amazing David Amram for his ability to be fascinated by this life full of action and music and conveying such in a way that makes the world much better off for his vision and presence. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.